Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swaminiti Namane Namaste Sarasvatevam Goravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschachare Shatarine Mukam Karoti Vachalam Pangam Longayate Girim Yatkripata Maham Vande Sri Gurum Dinataranam.
Alright, so let's begin again by just overviewing the points that we discussed yesterday that you found important, that you remember. We discussed Jiva Vegam, Udharopasta Vegam. We discussed the urges of the tongue, belly, and genitals. So any important points you remember from this discussion? Well, it just shows that one, even though one can be born under a certain constellation, be born in a certain family, a certain caste, that if he gets good association, then he can overcome his lower, you know, some, at least some aspect of his lower nature. So it means that if we associate with persons who are controlling the six urges, even though we may not, you know, have such good karma or have a good birth or anything, but if we associate with the persons who are controlling the six urges, then we can also develop those good qualities. Anything else? Anyone remembers? Yes, Atul Prabhu? Right. Controlling the tongue or the urge of controlling the urge of the tongue also means not overeating. You know, sometimes we think it only means eating only Krishna Prasad. Okay. But Prabhupada writes in the purport that if one offers food with the intent of enjoying it, then that's also a symptom that the urge of the tongue is not controlled. The beginning of controlling the belly and genitals, rather, how you control the belly and genitals is by controlling the urge of the tongue, or that's a determining factor. Regulation controlling the urge of the tongue means regulating the eating habits. And just like when we practice, let's say we only eat at, what time do you have breakfast? 9? And then lunch? Acha, 4. So you eat twice. So at 9 and 4, if we practice only eating at those times, then we just like when you exercise a muscle, it becomes strong. So if say between 9 and 4 you get hungry, but you practice tolerating the urge to eat, then you become practiced at being able to withstand the pushings of the senses. So now later, when the genitals push, you're already practiced to some degree in dealing with tolerating the urges of the senses. And so because you're practiced, then you'll have an easier time in controlling the other pushings. But it takes practice. So we practice by getting up at the same time, taking rest at the same time, eating at the same time, so on. And by doing that, we strengthen our ability to control the urges. And we know when a ship without a rudder means it cannot stay on course. So similarly, a person on the spiritual path will not be able to stay on course if he doesn't exercise some control of the tongue. Okay? Yeah. That's a good point. That's a very good point that Adi Purush brought up, that overeating is a symptom of some conflict, inner conflict. And therefore, that should be addressed. If we see someone's overeating, then we should understand maybe we have to probe beneath the surface and determine what is creating the anxiety and then address that so that the tongue can become controlled. That's a very good point, Arvind. This is in relation to controlling the pushings of the genitals. If we want to effectively not get the genitals agitated, we have to very carefully limit or restrict our association with the opposite sex. And Prabhupada writes that until one is perfectly self-realized, he should not relax these restrictions that are there in the Vedic culture of avoiding intermixing. If we want to effectively keep the senses controlled, then we have to experience a higher taste. Then automatically, just like if we go to the vegetable garden, we harvest all fresh vegetables and spices, and we make some nice soup, then automatically we lose our taste for canned soup. Isn't it? It's not like when you go to a grocery store and you see some canned soup on the that you have to hold back and resist from temptation from taking it. Because you have something better, you're not interested. So the senses become completely nicely controlled, or sense objects become of no interest when one actually experiences a higher taste. So we have to, again, perform activities which will tap us into getting a higher taste. Which means what? What are those activities? In general, what is the concept according to Nectar of Devotion? You have to execute activities which are favorable towards Krishna, right? And unmotivated. So if we offer any activity with a favorable attitude, that I'm doing it to please Krishna, I know it gives pleasure to Krishna, and I don't want anything in return from that, and it's free from karma, jnana, and yoga, it's not tinged by these things, then Krishna will reciprocate by giving us a higher taste. And then we will experience the pushings of the senses to be very, very far away from any creating any disturbance. They may still push. We may still detect something there, but it's far away. Actually, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, while we're in the body, we'll never experience a time where we don't perceive the pushings of the senses. They'll always be there, but of course, so small that they're not a disturbance. And as much as we're identifying with the body, that much will be affected by the pushings. I know one time we were sitting inside a room, a house, and we heard a car screeching, the tires screeching. Somebody's driving very fast on the road. Then we heard a smash. There was like an accident. So we went outside, and one of my friends saw his car was smashed against by this madman who was driving by. So when he saw his car smashed, his car was smashed, He became extremely distressed. And he was saying, oh no, who did this? Who's the rascal? How much is this going to cost for me to fix? He was in tears, actually. And then he looked at us, and because it wasn't our car, we were not affected. We were not feeling any different. But he was. Why? Because he's identifying with the car. He's thinking, this is my car. And so when something ill happens to the car, it affects him. So similarly, if we think, this is my body, I am this body, and then something happens to the body, or the urges of the senses of the body push, and we're identifying with the body, then we're affected. But if we're aloof from it, if we realize our spiritual nature, or at least the more we are in self-awareness, or the more we have achieved self-realization, the less effect the pleasure and pain of the body will affect us, or the demands of the body, the less the demands of the body will affect us. Okay, so let's go on to text 2. Atyahara prayashascha prajalpo niyamagraha janasangascha lolyamcha shadbid bhaktir vinasyati. Once devotional service is spoiled when he becomes too entangled in the following 6 activities. 1. Eating more than necessary or collecting more funds than required. 2. Over-endeavoring for mundane things that are very difficult to obtain. 3. Talking unnecessarily about mundane subject matters. 4. Practicing the scriptural rules and regulations only for the sake of following them and not for the sake of spiritual advancement, or rejecting the rules and regulations of the Scriptures and working independently or whimsically. 5, associating with worldly-minded persons who are not interested in Krishna consciousness. And 6, being greedy for mundane achievements. So I looked in the folio, this word vinasyati, sadbid bhakti vinasyati. And Prabhupada uses it in several places, or it appears in several places. And Prabhupada translates it like this: is annihilated, is lost, is vanquished, is destroyed, is spoiled. Krishna consciousness is lost. Vinasyati puts one in the wilderness of the material world. In another place, is finished. In another place, there's no hope to enter into spiritual life. So in other words, this word vinasyati is a superlative. Means it is a serious statement. Rupa Goswami is saying those who indulge in these 6 activities, their hope for bhakti is destroyed. So it means we should take these seriously, these 6 things. And if we're indulging in, if we find that we're not progressing in spiritual life, or we find that our progress is very slow, we can measure, we can go back to these 6 things. Which one of these 6 am I indulging in? Am I associate, is it, you know, and in this way we can trace out the source of our despondency. That's the important thing about these 6. Is that these are the places to look for how we may be creating obstacles for ourselves. So Prabhupada writes, he begins his purport discussing the 3, the internal potency, the marginal potency, and the external potency. And he talks about how we are tatastha shakti, the jivas are tatastha shakti, and how we can be influenced by the material or the spiritual energy. And largely we have a choice. We actually have a choice which of the superior or inferior energy to be influenced by. Then he begins to describe how the Mahatmas, what are their characteristics. He quotes Bhagavad Gita, Mahatmanastu mam partha daivim prakritim asrita bhajantyananya manaso gyatva bhutadim avyayam. O son of Prita, those who are not deluded, the great souls, are under the protection of the divine nature. They are fully engaged in devotional service because they know me as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, original and inexhaustible. So Prabhupada writes, the word Mahatma refers to those who are broad-minded, not cripple-minded. So he's saying, indirectly he's saying, cripple-minded people, then they do not indulge, rather they indulge in these 6 activities that destroyed bhakti. And Mahatmas, they avoid them. Cripple-minded persons always engage in satisfying their senses, sometimes expand their activities in order to do good for others through some ism like nationalism, humanitarianism, and altruism. They may reject personal sense and gratification for the sense gratification of others, like the members of their family, community, or society. Then he says, but such activities have no spiritual value. The basis of such activity is sense gratification, either personal or extended. Only when a person gratifies the senses of the Supreme Lord can he be called Mahatma, or broad-minded. So he's now pointing out more, in other words, sometimes materialists appear very pious because they build an eye hospital or they build a school for the deaf. They So it appears that they are pious. One may call them Mahatmas. So Prabhupada is making a distinction that these things, this philanthropic activity, humanitarianism, this is just extended sense enjoyment. From my sense enjoyment to another group of people's, I'm concerned about another person's sense enjoyment. So he said, these are not Mahatmas. Mahatmas are those who are focused on serving the senses of Krishna and giving pleasure to the senses of Krishna. That is a Mahatma, to be distinguished from a pious man. In another place, of course, Prabhupada is also pointing out the Mahatmas, their main characteristic is that they're focused on giving pleasure to Krishna. I'm sorry, you had something, you raised your hand earlier. So he's saying that the main characteristic of Mahatma is that they're focused on pleasing Krishna and not other living entities. So in another place in Hitopadesa, there's a very nice verse that gives further symptoms of a Mahatma, symptoms of his behavior. He said, there's a verse that says, Manasyan yad bachasyan yat karmanyan yad duratmanam manasyekam vachasyekam karmanyekam mahatmanam. It's a contrast. First line describes the duratma and the second line describes the mahatma, so we can get a contrast of further characteristics. The translation is, there is one thing in the mind, another thing in the speech, and a third thing in the actions of the duratmas. Means what they're thinking in their mind is not the same as what they say, and what they say is not the same as what they do. It means there's crookedness, right? It means, oh, Haribol Prabhu, you're from ISKCON, you're from ISKCON. Oh, very good, come in my shop, I'm the life member. Right? He's saying we have something in common, we're friends. But that's not what it is in his mind. In his mind, he's saying, ah, here's an Angrezi, I'm going to take him for every paisa he's got. But he says, oh, you're my friend, we have something in common. Come in my shop, I'm the life member. And then he's thinking, he's doing something entirely different from what he's thinking. Right? So this is a symptom of a wicked person or a duratma. That his thought is not the same with his speech, and his speech is not in line with his action. And the Mahatma, how you tell a Mahatma is there's one thing in his mind, the same thing in his speech, and the same thing in his action. It means what? Huh? All right. Honest? Consistency. Okay. Well, it doesn't necessarily. Well, yeah. We could say this is a symptom of a pure devotee. Also, it's a symptom of straightforwardness, which is a Vaishnava characteristic. Of course, now that there's another level. It's like we see in Krishna Lila. They're not always straight. Right. We see that sometimes in the pastimes of Radha and Krishna, they say things that they don't mean. But again, it's not rooted in the desire to manipulate or enjoy for one's own pleasure. It's done with the intent to give pleasure to Krishna. So again, the motive. But in general, though in practice in this material, you know, for practicing, again, for looking for symptoms of who is a Vaishnava or who's fit to take instruction from, who's a Mahatma, a practical observation is that they are straightforward and they're honest. So the position of a Mahatma is that he's under the control of the Lord's Daivim Prakritim, or the internal potency. He's under the control of the divine energy, and the Duratma is under the control of the inferior energy. So this internal potency, external potency. Those who are under the influence of Maya, they are called Duratmas. Those who are under the influence of the divine potency, they're referred to as Mahatmas. So then, Atyahara. Prabhupada writes on page 18, according to nature's arrangement, living entities lower on the evolutionary scale do not eat or collect more than necessary. I see it daily with cows. If a cow has a quota of water, you can put a bucket of water in front of them, they won't drink. They never drink for just like sense enjoyment. They drink when they need water, otherwise they don't drink. You can push their nose in there, they won't drink. They may overeat, But they're not so low on the evolutionary scale. The lower you go down the evolutionary scale, the more one is controlled by nature, by his nature. Consequently, in the animal kingdom, there is generally no economic problem or scarcity of necessities. If a bag of rice is placed in a public place, birds will come and eat a few grains and go away. However, a human being will take away the whole bag because he's under the, or he's an atyahari. He is hoarding more than necessary. And Prabhupada says, now the entire world is suffering because of it. As we mentioned yesterday, this is one of the modern causes of shortages. People are hoarding more than necessary. Then, what is the cause of this hoarding mentality? It's the enjoying spirit. The enjoying spirit is the cause of misery. Dukkha yonaya evate. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that, in 5:22, he says, an intelligent person does not take part in the sources of misery. Dukkha yonaya evate. And the sources are due to contact with the material senses. O son of Kunti, such pleasures have a beginning and an end, and the wise man does not delight in them. So a wise man then does not go chasing after sense enjoyment. He does, his motive is not to get more sense enjoyment. So therefore he does not become an atyahari. He does not become one who hoards more than necessary, keeps more than required. Now especially regarding, in other words, if you hoard more than necessary, what does it do? How does it affect your relationship with Krishna? Let's think on a practical level. If you hoard more than necessary, yes, Prabhu? Yes, very good. If you, let's say you have a big, you have a bank account. Of course, if you're a householder, you're allowed to have a bank account. At least within certain limits. But let's say we have, especially a renunciate, a brahmachari, a vanaprastha, or a sannyasi, if they have a bank account, then the tendency will be that they'll come to rely on that as a security. And they'll become dependent on that and not on Krishna. And spiritual advancement is, progress in spiritual life is interrelated with being dependent on Krishna. The more dependent you are on Krishna, the more you'll feel his presence. The more dependent we are on Krishna, the more he is obliged to take care of us. If he has, he says, I give my special, he says, what is that verse? In the 10th canto, I forget the Sanskrit, but he says, to those, he said that's one, but another one is, to those who are, what is it? He says,
something about bestowing his special mercy. There's a seat over there. Yasyaham anugrinami. What's the translation? He says that when I give my special mercy to someone, I take away all his wealth. I take away all his possessions. And in that state, even all his friends, they reject him. They reject the poor and wretched fellow. So in other words, it means a symptom of special mercy is that one has no other shelter other than Krishna. And as one eliminates all other shelters, then Krishna is, you know, if one eliminates all other shelters for the purpose of serving Krishna, then Krishna is obligated to reciprocate with that person because of his promise. And so therefore, the more we put ourselves, not foolishly, but the more we put ourselves under the care of Krishna, the more we will perceive how he reciprocates with us, and the more our faith will grow, and consequently the more progressive we will become in spiritual life. So by hoarding more than necessary, by keeping more money than required, we are allowed a certain amount for emergencies, but by hoarding more than that, it is atyahara. It is detrimental. It destroys one's ability to develop devotion. So later, well, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says then this atyahara, the way it's applied, it applies differently towards householders than it does towards the members of the other ashrams. It says a householder, he is allowed to keep some storage of food or of wealth for emergencies, because he's obligated to. If a guest comes to his house, he has to cook. He has social and cultural obligations. If a brahmachari or a renunciate comes to his house begging, he should be able to supply. So he has to take into account that I have to supply my family members, I have to provide for my family members, but he also takes the responsibility that he has to supply for the brahmacharis in the community, the sannyasis in the community, and even poor people, and even animals in the community. We see in living in Vrindavan, you see all the people in the neighborhood, all the ladies who, after cooking, they bring all the cuttings of the vegetables, they put in a place for the cows. And then rejected foodstuffs they put in the place for the pigs and the dogs. And this way the householders provide. So many dogs are depending on the householders in the neighborhood. So the householders then are allowed a certain amount, but not so much that they think, now I don't have to rely on Krishna. They should have enough to maintain their family, and they can have more to maintain their guests. Prabhupada, one time in giving instructions to some householders who just got married, he said, well, what they said, what is the duty? They asked Prabhupada, what's the duty of a householder? And he said, well, you should cook, you should keep deities in your home. You should cook every day for the deities. You should make the offering. Then after making the offering, you should transfer everything. Then you should go outside the door in the street and say in a very loud voice, anyone who's hungry, please come to my house. I'm serving prasad now. And anyone who comes, the husband and wife, they should serve. And if more people come than they prepared for, they should cook again. And like this, they should provide. And if every householder does that, then there will be no shortage. All the beggars, all the brahmacharis, all the sannyasis will be easily fed, because the householders comprise the larger portion of the varnashram. So there will be no shortages. There will be no burden on the householders either if everyone does this. So giving and seeing that, if like for the householders who do this and actually extend themselves, then they'll see how Krishna will provide them. They'll also cultivate detachment. That my hard-earned wealth is being used like this, I'm giving it away, and actually, because I'm doing it in Krishna's service, Krishna will reciprocate and provide more for that person to give, provide what that householder requires. Why he does that?
Well, it's his duty. It's his scriptural duty.
And in other words, the spiritual master, in this Vedic model, the spiritual master is teaching. It's a gurukula, right? So the spiritual master is imparting knowledge to the student. So that takes time. He has to prepare his lessons. He has to spend time in class. He has to clarify. He spends his time in teaching the students. So the students, by nature, rather, by they're obligated to also provide something for the spiritual master. So they go and beg, and they get some rice, they get some dal, they get some vegetables, they get some firewood, they get whatever the spiritual master requires. In other words, because he's sacrificing his time to teach them, he doesn't have time to go and get firewood, to go get vegetables and so forth. So the students do that in reciprocation. And so that's one of the purposes. One of the purposes is that they're reciprocating with the spiritual master. They're developing an interdependence, an interrelationship. And when they appreciate that the spiritual master is dispelling their doubts, removing their obstacles, they feel inspired and they naturally want to reciprocate and give something back. And so they can do so in this manner, by going and begging, happily begging, going to the household and say, please offer something I want to give to my spiritual master. And in this way, when they provide something for the spiritual master, then he feels, okay, these people are actually helping me accomplish, these students are helping me accomplish my prescribed duties. I'm indebted to them, so he feels like I want to give more. It's compared to like a cow, when she has a full bag of milk, that it irritates her. It creates, they say, like a burning sensation. She's uncomfortable. She needs the calf to come. And the calf has got a burning sensation in his stomach that he wants to take the milk. And so they serve each other. When the mother gives milk, the calf gets great relief from hunger. And when the calf takes the milk, the mother feels relief from getting rid of that excess that is causing her discomfort. And so the spiritual master, when he has an opportunity to teach good students, he becomes enlivened, because by teaching, the knowledge becomes alive for him also. And so he's interested in teaching, especially those who are reciprocating with him. And so it is the basis of developing surida soridam, means firm friendship, an attitude of firm friendship with the spiritual master. That's the most important thing. The other thing is, it's explained by Narada Muni, that by begging on behalf of the spiritual master, one can practice, one can learn tolerance, because sometimes people will reject you. Yeah, get out of here. We don't want any bums in here. So he'll learn to become tolerant. He'll learn patience, and he'll learn humility. There's no place, there's no institution, there's no university. Can you go to Cambridge University and say, I want to have a course in humility, tolerance, and patience. Please teach me. Huh? No. So in order to do that, you must follow Brahmachari Dharma. In order to develop, it's one of the things that Brahmachari should learn is good character. How to develop his character and how to control his senses. How to learn sacrifice for the spiritual master. But in order for the brahmachari to do that with a proper attitude, he must know within himself that my spiritual master is caring for me. It's not just a one-way thing where I'm giving and the spiritual master is taking and not providing. In other words, then the exchange is disrupted. If the brahmachari does not feel protected, What will happen? If the brahmachari goes out and begs, but he feels no protection from the spiritual master, what happens?
He'll keep something.
Exactly. He'll say, well, I'm not being cared for. I better keep a little bit aside, just in case. Just in case. And then it starts. Then there's a block in the relationship. And then, as it goes on, well, it's very difficult for love and trust to develop. And then, because love and trust is not there,
then there's a difficulty in transmitting knowledge. Then the whole thing becomes spoiled gradually, unless that shifts. Unless by revealing one's mind in confidence and by bringing it to the attention of the spiritual master, then these things can be corrected. But if we experience that before it deteriorates into something worse, we should have the brahmachari should, or the whoever, the disciple should have the should feel the responsibility to bring it into the open. Yes. In other words, I let me just make sure I understood what you said. That sometimes the brahmachari in the temple may be sent out to collect alms for the spiritual master. But then, and those alms are required to maintain the temple. And then, in order to delegate responsibility, the brahmachari is given a certain quota to collect. Is that what you said? And each one of us takes on a certain quota that we must collect in order to provide for the necessities of the temple. But that in the process of doing that, one may forget his purpose. Is that what you're saying? In other words, let's say I've seen it where if one comes back to the temple without his quota, then he's treated one way. And if he comes back with his quota or more than his quota, he's treated another way. And so therefore what happens is those who are productive in the field of collecting money, they get more attention or more praise from the spiritual master. They get privileges that those who are not expert in collecting alms do not get. And that creates a two-tiered system. Even though it may not be. Now the other thing that enters in is it may not be one's forte. It may not be the brahmachari's expertise to go out and beg alms. He may be expert in serving another way. But if begging alms is stressed more than, say, cleaning the temple, doing the deity worship, receiving guests, cooking the prasadam, serving the deity, if begging alms is considered an exclusive service, and doing the brahmacharis who do the other activities are considered lower, then this is not proper either. So now, of course, the purpose, in other words, the purpose of going and begging alms again is to please the spiritual master, to reciprocate with the spiritual master. But if it becomes a business, then also one will experience disruption. And if it becomes that those who can collect are glorified and given privileges, or even among that particular group seen as more advanced or seen as more surrendered to the spiritual master, and we start to again attribute, we start to respect these qualities rather than that they're able to control the six urges, that they're humble, that they're honest, and so on, then the priorities become mixed up. It becomes unhealthy. And obviously one's spiritual life can become disrupted. You know the story in Mahabharata about, what was his name? Upamanyu. Upamanyu. You know that story? Briefly, Upamanyu was not very bright. He was in the school of a guru, but he was not excelling in studies. But that did not disqualify him. But the spiritual master said, okay, so your duty will be to take the cows out every day and make them graze. After the milking, you take the cows out. While the other boys study, you do your service to me will be to take the cows out instead of studying. So he did. And in other words, it just points out that some brahmacharis, it may not be their forte to study, or it may not be their forte to collect alms. But that does not mean the spiritual master is not pleased with them. If he sees if they're doing something else, taking the cows out is a big responsibility. It relieves the spiritual master of a lot of duties also. So he would send him like that. Luke? I've also seen the grihasthas sometimes borrow money from the sannyasis. They ask for loans, and the sannyasis are known to sometimes give. So again, these are we have to examine. Say, like, if a brahmachari, in other words, again, I think it goes back, when the brahmachari does not feel protected, then a tendency will be for him to keep something for emergencies. Now, how he uses that, how much that is, and how he uses it will determine how much of it is a problem with Atyahara. Let's say he buys a bus, but he uses the bus strictly for preaching and bringing people to the spiritual master, to Krishna. So then it will not have an ill effect. It will not block his development of bhakti. But if he uses it for his own personal comforts or for some other sense enjoyment, then it will block. It will have a blocking effect on his development of bhakti. Similarly, like Prabhupada was given so much money, and if he were to use the money for sense gratification, then it would have, and then he would be implicated in Atyahara. Whereas if he uses it always in Krishna's service, then he's not an Atyahari. Even though he may have at any given point in time more than he requires, but the fact that he's using it or prepared to use it in Krishna's service, or at least not using it in his own for his own selfish means, then he's not implicated in Atyahara.
It seems like back to the example, the way he states it in this commentary is quite differently, or emphatically.
Very emphatically. The brahmacharis and the sannyasis.
So you think we should accept this principle as a detail which we can change before?
No, the principle is the same. But my point is, in other words, okay, let's say I'm a temple president and I'm not taking care of the brahmacharis. I'm just flogging you guys. I'm sending you out to collect and you're turning in all the money, and when you need clothes, when you need medical assistance, I say, hey, there's a guy over there who's a doctor. Go ask him if he'll treat you free. You know what I mean? And you feel that from me. You feel that I'm unconcerned. You feel I'm only taking and not giving. So then you start collecting. Then I'm the president and I find, hey, you're collecting. And I say, okay, you're kicked out of the ashram. Right? So, and then everyone, all the other brahmacharis see this. So what does it do? It's dysfunctional, right? In other words, I'm the cause of your defect. you're collecting more than necessary because you feel that I'm not protecting you, and I punish you for that. Right? So are you wrong? Or rather, I'm wrong, and because of you associating with me, you're becoming wrong. You're doing the wrong thing. But whose fault is it? If we trace it back, it's my fault. So therefore, I'm actually being offensive, and I'm actually not helping you progress in spiritual life. I'm actually creating problems for your spiritual progress. So I'll have to suffer for that in the end. But in other words, if a brahmachari... So let's say we discover in the ashram a brahmachari is collecting more than necessary. Well, let's find out why. Let's see why. Maybe he had a bad experience in the past at a boarding school, and he needs some special attention. And that's why. And so, in other words, if we're actually concerned about the individual, we'll extend ourselves to find out, okay, he's implicated in Atyahara, so is 99% of the world implicated in Atyahara. How to help him overcome the Atyahara, the tendency. We do not expect just because a person moves in, whack, his attachment, rather his bad habit of Atyahara is cut. We should take the responsibility of guiding one so that they can overcome it. And we should examine, am I not creating the problem? And so therefore, if we see a brahmachari is collecting, okay, then, and we see it's because of our own inadequacy, then we should think, okay, I have to change my program. I have to be more loving. I have to demonstrate my care more, or I have to become more concerned. And if I, in other words, the way to correct it is by becoming more concerned and making the brahmacharis feel very secure and cared for and valued. One can address a problem like that. Because if the brahmachari feels uncared for and I take away his only security, then he may just say, to hell with this, I can't practice spiritual life. And we shouldn't expect him to when he's not feeling the protection, the love from the spiritual master. Exactly. Right, right. I've seen it. I've experienced it. Where you collect money, you give it for a certain purpose, or they're saying, we need to collect the money for this purpose, and it's not used for that purpose. And it's used for some, and we see that somehow the authorities are increasing in their opulence, and they're becoming extravagant. And it has to be, they have no other source of income. So we become discouraged. And that's their fault we're discouraged, because they're not setting the right example. So what should one do? Let's say if you experience this in your temple, if you experience that you're being abused or you're being manipulated, What choices do you have? In other words, if you know, I used to like to go out and collect and happily turn it over because I thought it was being used properly. Now I'm suspect that it's not, and I have good reason. And I reveal my mind to others, they have the same suspicion. So now what is my choice? You can protest to your authority's authority. Okay, you can directly approach the authority like Lord Brahma's sons approached him. I know one time that happened to me. Anyways, or what else? What other options do we have? Okay, indirect approach. That's called what? Instructing the daughter instead of the daughter-in-law, right? When the mother wants to instruct the daughter-in-law, she's a little bit more distant, so she'll tell her daughter in front of the daughter-in-law something, and that way she gets the message. So that's a good technique. What else?
If you don't speak up when you're feeling, when somebody is doing something that you know is wrong and it frustrates you and you don't speak up, what happens is you just repress anger. And then it comes out hurting you more, right? Your attitude goes sour. You're not happy anymore. Your preaching is not as effective because you're angry. So then it hurts you to hold it in. Sometimes, well, I shouldn't say anything because I don't want to get anybody upset. But if we do that excessively, then we're the ones that suffer. The other thing you can do is actually find another authority. Huh? Who's abusing you? You're saying if you make your authority aware that you may get chastised? Okay. You will be seen. In other words, if you protest, if you have a valid complaint and you go to an abusive authority, then he will punish you for having a valid complaint. And he will say to the others, just see what a offender he is, right? So then what is your choice? Then one of your choices is to find another authority. But okay, so then you save yourself. You save yourself. You save yourself in that way. But what about others that are being abused? You save yourself, but are you helping the others that are also being abused?
That's not the best approach. That is not the best approach.
What he's saying. Anyway, you save yourself.
Yeah.
But I'm saying I suspect the best scenario is you go to the authority and you try to reason with them. Just like the example is Marichi and the brothers that went to Lord Brahma. In other words, you may get more anger, but we should be prepared. In other words, because why should we be satisfied if I get out of the abuse, but everyone else is being abused, or others are being abused? And if you abuse other devotees, you're actually abusing yourself. You cannot be happy when you abuse other devotees. You cannot progress when you abuse others. So if we're allowing ourselves to be abused, we're also allowing that person to dig himself into a hole as well. Yes, Prabhu.
Usually the temple council,
okay. If it's healthy, then right. So there should be some arrangement to keep a healthy atmosphere. Okay, so at least you know your rights. If you are abused, you know you have certain rights as a human being, as a Vaishnava, certain parameters within which you can work. Okay. So Atyahara. Prahlad Maharaj says, very interesting wisdom here. In this material world, every materialist desires to achieve happiness and diminishes distress, and therefore he acts accordingly. Actually, however, one is happy as long as one does not endeavor for happiness. As soon as one begins his activities for happiness, his conditions of distress begin. In other words, if we understand this wisdom, this will help us avoid collecting more than required or striving for material happiness. We will not find material happiness in hoarding things. As soon as we focus on trying to achieve happiness ourselves, that's when our distress begins. This is the wisdom of Prahlad Maharaj. And another interesting thing is, of course, to see how the Lord is providing. It's like Prabhupada gives the example that an elephant requires 100 kilos of grass every day to live. But the Lord is providing, somehow the elephant gets.
And the birds require, some birds require to eat more foodstuff than their own bodily weight. But there's so many seeds, there's so many insects abounding. So they get their quota. And then in the Hitopadesha explains, the proof that the Lord is providing for the living entity, in other words, if the Lord provides for the animals, He'll certainly provide for the human beings. And the proof that, and further proof is, when the child is in the womb, he's being fed internally through the, I think through the blood, the mother's blood circuit, I don't know. Somehow or other, the nutrition from the mother goes into the child's body, and the child is being nourished within. Krishna's providing for his nourishment while he's in the womb. While he's in the womb, milk does not flow from the breast of the mother. But as soon as the child comes out of the womb, as soon as the umbilical cord is cut, another arrangement is made by the Supreme Lord that milk starts to flow. As soon as the umbilical cord is cut and that arrangement to nourish the child is no more, then there's another arrangement. Instinctively, he starts to suck and the mother gives milk. So just see how the Lord is providing for the infants, so He will also provide for us. He's also, when upon the birth of this body, this is what is meant with this Om Purnama Dapurnamidam, that the Lord is perfect and complete and He creates other perfect and complete things. That when He creates this body, along with the creation of the body, He creates enough air, enough water, enough food to maintain the body. And so, therefore, all we have to do is focus on serving God, and these things will come. And using our human talents to get these things. So if we can understand this principle, then this will help us avoid atyahara. Even I've seen many devotees who, let's say, carrying on with your scenario, a person was abused by a certain temple authority, right? And so therefore, he left the temple. But because of his determination to continue serving Krishna and Guru, he was sincere, and he still tried to serve, he still has a desire to serve Guru and Krishna. Then I've seen many people come and say, and Krishna provided for me another way. In other words, the temple did not provide for me, but because I was determined to serve, I'm seeing how Krishna is providing for me through some other agency. So if one gets that kind of realization, that kind of reciprocation, then his faith becomes stronger. And he realizes, nobody has a monopoly. Nobody has a monopoly on service to Guru and Krishna. So then Prabhupada goes on talking in several places. Just like yesterday, we discussed a little bit about don't hoard food and about the pastime in Chaitanya Lila, where Lord Chaitanya chastised his servant because he was keeping things for tomorrow. He was hoarding food for tomorrow, thinking, I may not have enough today, so let us keep something for tomorrow. But Prabhupada in another place says that you are allowed to hoard so only a certain amount, and the storage place of the body is the stomach. You're allowed to hoard that much. You're allowed to fill your stomach. Once your stomach is filled, that's how much you're allowed to hoard. And if you fill your stomach, means how long can you live with? If you fill your stomach today, how long can you live? Huh? A few weeks. Easy. 2 weeks, 15 days, easy. Maybe even 30, 40 days. Depending on how much you have stored outside your stomach. You can easily live. 3 weeks. First few days are difficult, but after fasting 2-3 days, no problem. So, if you're serving Krishna and you fill your belly today, you should have confidence that within 3 weeks, I'll get to fill it again. At least for a renunciate. Yes, Prabhu.
Mayapur. For it's possible. Well, then it's,
it's not a mature outlook. If one does not understand that we're all individuals, we all have different capacities, then he's not very mature, not a mature vision. It's like everyone may be thinking, how come he has his notebook? How come he has a computer and I don't have a computer? Right? You didn't bring your computer today? You have it. Okay. So one may be thinking like that, but maybe he has a mission. He's being sent here to learn or to take notes because he's going to be teaching in Mayapur Institute of Higher Education. He has certain purposes. So if we don't know that, in other words, we should allow for that. Maybe his spiritual master sent him or his authority sent him to accomplish this, accomplish that. We don't all have to have that. So similarly, if we see one person is eating more or requires more than us, that's all right. But if he's taking more than he requires, that's atyahara. Arvind? Well, I don't think in other words, in general, you should not keep you should only keep that which does not disrupt your dependence on Krishna. You follow? In other words, if I have more than I require, then I will find that I am not depending on Guru and Krishna. Then I have too much. In other words, again, the principle is whatever's favorable, whether always think of Krishna and never forget Krishna. This is the bottom line. And in remembering Krishna, what is favorable and what is unfavorable. We accept those things that are favorable and we reject those things that are unfavorable. So let's say I'm in an abusive environment in the temple. But I have enough that if I get thrown out of the temple for speaking up, I know I have a place. I mean, I have a certain amount that I can land on and keep me some food or maintain myself for a week or 2 weeks or whatever. So therefore, now I can continue in that abusive situation and stand up for the truth. Right. So then, good. But if you have more than that, that may not be good. If you have so much that you start to think, well, I need this, I need that, I can afford this, I can afford that, I can get my own place, and then if these things are not favorable, then it will have a negative effect. So again, the rule should be, is keeping this amount disturbing my dependence on Krishna and Guru? No. Okay. Then you're not experiencing atyahara. In other words, just like the Goswamis, they were allowed to have something for emergencies, right? Sanatan Goswami had a fund for emergencies and it saved his life. He gave it as a bribe to the jailer. And they were renunciates. But they were allowed something. According to time and circumstance, as long as it's not interfering with your tendency to take shelter and surrender to Krishna. So, No, I agree with you. It could be an advantage. But in other words, I think we have to examine the what we mean by dependent on Krishna. Doesn't mean we should be financially dependent on Krishna. The householders, it's not favorable for him to be financially dependent on being maintained by the temple. So if he maintains himself and stands on his own and gives money to the temple, that doesn't mean that he's not dependent on Krishna. Right? It may mean he's very responsible. But again, it may not mean that he's dependent on Krishna either. But we have to examine it. If he's, in other words, if he's relying on his own talents that have been given by Krishna, and he develops a business and makes money to provide for his family and maintain the temple, I say he's depending on Krishna. Right? He's depending on Krishna's, the talents Krishna's given him. And he's using his intelligence and in a way to manage what's coming in. And he's using his intelligence to make sure the fruits of his work are used in Krishna's service. That's dependence on Krishna. Not that dependence means that I'm crippled and that I'm just waiting for a handout. And if they don't, you know, and then if I provide for myself, I'm not dependent. No. Yes, Prabhu. Madhavendra Puri. Yes. The more you become independent from mundane shelters. Yeah. Right. Right. He got on the Jaladuta. Great independent step. But why? Because he was practiced at depending on Krishna. So he could take great risks. Yes. Artificial life removes one away from Krishna. We're thinking, if I pay the water bill, I get water. We're not thinking that I have to do yajna to get rain. We're not thinking. We're so far removed that we're thinking that because we have a powerhouse, electric powerhouse, I have elevator, I have all these things. We're removed so far from Krishna that we can't remember him. So in teaching Atyahara, or the principle, there's an interesting anecdote where Prabhupada was walking on the roof in Mayapur on the long building in the morning, on a morning walk on the building. And several sannyasis were there. And one big life member was there with his, you know, silk kurta, cotton dhoti, and his little, what do they call those hats? Nehru hat, like a Nehru hat, walking with Prabhupada. A big man, a factory owner, industrialist. So Prabhupada asked him, so what is your business? And the man said, we make glass. And Prabhupada said, so where do you know glass? Yeah, all kinds of glass. So he says, okay, so how do you make glass? He said, from silicone sand. He says, we get the sand and we melt it, refine it, and make glass. He says, well, where do you get the sand? He says, well, we get it from Bhagawan. We get it from Bhagawan. So Prabhupada then said, oh, you're stealing from Bhagawan. And the man was, everybody laughed and the man was quiet. And then he said, well, yes, we're taking from Bhagawan, but then we're making glass and we're selling the glass and we're giving some portion of our earnings to Bhagawan. So then Prabhupada said, well, then you're just a small thief. Then you're only a small thief, not a big thief. So the principle, of course, of Atyahara is that, in other words, if you're hoarding, you've become a very, very wealthy man from hoarding, then you are guilty of Atyahara. But of course, if you use your wealth, in other words, if you have wealth, that is not a sin. But how you use the wealth, just like many wealthy people, there's a man who's very wealthy and he has to give a certain amount. In other words, the government, if you make a lot of money, the government taxes you and takes away the money. But if you give away a certain amount of money to a charitable institution, then the government can't tax you on that money. So one devotee, he's very wealthy, and so he knows the government is going to take away a few hundred thousand dollars every year. So instead, he made a trust for giving scholarships to Gurukul graduates. So he's using his money in Krishna's service. So there's so many ways that a person can have an excess but use them in a constructive Krishna conscious way and not be an atyahari. Okay, anything else? Any other discussion on atyahara? Or any other thing? He goes the other way. I've not seen anything mentioned. I mean, there may be, but I've read the commentary of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, and Prabhupada. They don't mention, but that doesn't mean there's not a connection. But offhand, I can look, but offhand, I don't. I'm not aware of one. Anyone else is aware of one?
Question is, I think Goswami starts explaining Padashamrita with the things that we should not do spoils devotional service, and then tells you positive things. He starts with negative, what spoils it, and he starts with positive, what you should do. Is there any significance in that sequence? Because
yeah, he explains what niyama before yama, right? He explains the restrictions before he explains the do nots before the do's. Sorry. Okay, the other way. Well, whatever, but I'm saying we see he's explaining the do not. He's saying give up these six things, and then the next verse he says embrace these six things. So he's just questioning if anyone knows or if anyone can deduce what might be his purpose. Adi Purush?
It's a general sequence. Also, the first go, first we have yama, then yama. If you're engaged in some nonsense,
give that up.
Stop this nonsense, just stop. Don't
do this. Okay. Good point. In other words, if I tell you to do all this and you're still doing the nonsense, it will undermine the, or it could. But then again, in a preaching technique, we say chant Hare Krishna, that's all, and don't worry about illicit sex and stopping that and meat eating and all that. We say just chant Hare Krishna, at least begin. So it's an interesting point. It's an interesting thing to explore.
Just the six things that occur, they are called six passions. That means they are not the...
They're rajas. The first six things, chaya bega dami, please help me control the six passions, refers to the first verse. Anyway, that's something interesting to think about. We can think about it, and tomorrow if anyone has any revelations, you can present them. Anything else before we stop today? Let me just see here. Another way to avoid atyahara is to practice santushta. Santushta in the Bhagavad Gita, in several places, in the 12th chapter, you know, in the end of the 12th chapter, when Krishna starts to list all the things that please him. What is it? Advesta sarva bhutana maitra karuna evacha nirmamo nirahankara samaduka sukakshami santushto santushta satatam yogi.
That one should be satisfied with anything. One should practice being satisfied with anything. So if we practice being satisfied with anything, this can also help counteract the tendency towards atyahara. Ultimately, if we cultivate dependence on Krishna, even if we have an abusive authority, we will not be affected because we'll have the confidence that Krishna will provide for us. That does not mean we necessarily have to tolerate abuse, right? Doesn't mean we just have to tolerate abuse, but we won't be disturbed. Finally, or there's many things to discuss, but we can end by... So yesterday was Vamanadeva's appearance day, and he had instructions that can help us overcome atyahara. Lord Vamana said, O King, controller of the entire universe, although he's talking to Bali, although you are very munificent and are able to give me as much land as I want, I do not want anything from you that is unnecessary. He's an example of one who's overcome Matyahara. As a brahmachari, he's a brahmachari brahman. So he says, even the entirety of whatever there may be within the three worlds to satisfy one's senses cannot satisfy a person's whose senses are uncontrolled. In other words, if the senses are uncontrolled, no matter how much you give a person, he'll not be satisfied. If I were not satisfied with three paces of land, then surely I would not be satisfied even with possessing one of the seven islands consisting of nine varshas. Even if I possessed one island, I would hope to get more. We have heard that although powerful kings like Maharaj Prithu and Maharaj Gaya achieved proprietorship over the seven dvipas, they could not achieve satisfaction or find the end of their ambitions. One should be satisfied with whatever he achieves by his previous destiny, for discontent can never bring happiness. A person who is not self-controlled will not be happy, even with possessing the three worlds. Material existence causes discontent in regard to fulfilling one's lusty desires and achieving more and more money. This is the cause for the continuation of material life, which is full of repeated birth and death. But one who is satisfied by that which is obtained by destiny is fit for liberation from this material existence. A brahmana who is satisfied with whatever is providentially obtained is increasingly enlightened with spiritual power. But the spiritual potency of a dissatisfied brahmana decreases as fire diminishes in potency when water is sprinkled on it. In other words, he's saying a brahmana's power is diminished if he is dissatisfied. And his power is increased if he can learn how to be satisfied with whatever is given to him. So if we can understand this principle, it will help us to stop hoarding. These are a series of verses in the 8th canto, chapter 19, verses 17 through 27. 8, 19, verses 17 through 27. 11 verses where Vamanadeva is speaking in answer to Bali's Maharaj telling him, you're less intelligent, you should ask for something more. I'm the king of the universe. I'm capable of giving you much more than three paces of land. And Vamana, who was a brahmachari, who only had 11 things, he only had 11 possessions. Okay, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.